All right, let's jump right in. Today we're doing a deep dive into this pretty intense article from American Thinker.
Yeah, it's a conservative publication.
Right, and they're making some pretty big claims about woke ideology like it's on the decline.
They're talking about DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and CRT, critical race theory.
Yeah, and they're saying this silent majority is pushing back against these ideas.
Like, as proof, they're pointing to Walmart scaling back their DEI program.
And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez taking the pronouns out of her ex profile.
Yeah, they don't hold back either, calling DEI and CRT like preposterous and racist philosophies.
Broke 'em even.
Exactly.
But the thing that I found really interesting was this whole argument that DEI and CRT are basically tools of Marxism.
Yeah, designed to disrupt society, they even say.
Do you think that comparison like holds any water?
It's a powerful way to put it, that's for sure. And it's not exactly a new idea either, you know, this whole Marxist infiltration thing.
Right.
It kind of plays on these anxieties that people have about like big social changes. These anxieties have been around forever.
Yeah.
It's almost like they're tapping into those old Cold War fears, right? Making these ideas sound really dangerous.
Un-American.
Exactly. And the interesting thing is how well that kind of talk works with some people, even though it's really oversimplifying things.
So you're saying it's more about like getting people riled up than having a real conversation.
Exactly. When you look at DEI, for example, it's really about trying to make things more inclusive, you know, addressing those systemic barriers that marginalized groups face.
Sure.
And CRT, it's about looking at how race and racism are kind of baked into our systems and institutions.
Okay.
It's not about blaming individuals.
More.
It's more about understanding how all these historical and current structures contribute to these racial disparities we see.
Which is totally different from like trying to overthrow the government.
Yeah, exactly.
The article also spends a lot of time talking about how DEI has actually hurt institutions, like the military specifically. They even mentioned this Heritage Foundation report that rated the U.S. military as weak, and they're putting the blame on DEI policies. So, how should we interpret a claim like that?
That's where I think it's super important to understand like where the information is coming from.
Okay.
So the Heritage Foundation, they're a pretty well-known conservative think tank,
Right.
and their research tends to, you know, reflect a particular political perspective. So while the data they're using might be accurate, the way they interpret it, the conclusions they draw, well, they're probably shaped by their ideology.
So it's kind of like.
It's a really good example of how what we already believe can totally change how we see and understand information.
Looking at the same picture, but seeing something totally different.
Exactly.
So does that mean we should just ignore everything they say?
Not necessarily, but I think it's a good reminder to be a little skeptical, especially with information coming from sources that have, you know, clear political leanings. And when it comes to something as complicated as military readiness,
Right.
there are just so many factors involved.
Yeah.
To say it's all because of DEI policies, well, that's oversimplifying a very complex issue.
It's like blaming one ingredient for a cake not rising when you didn't even follow the recipe.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, let's shift gears for a minute. The article also takes a shot at this McKinsey study from 2015 that found a link between diversity and corporate profitability. They mentioned a Wall Street Journal piece that questioned how the study was done, implying that maybe the connection isn't as strong as McKinsey claimed. So, how much weight should we really give to one study? Especially one that's been challenged like this.
You've hit on a really important point about scientific research, and that's replication and scrutiny.
Okay.
So one study, even from a big firm like McKinsey, it's never the final word.
Right.
And that Wall Street Journal critique, that's valuable because it makes the researchers address any potential problems, and it encourages others to try and replicate those findings.
So it's a constant process.
Exactly. It's like this back and forth that helps make sure the science is as solid as it can be.
It's like refining a recipe. You try it out, get feedback,
Yeah.
make adjustments, and keep going until it's perfect.
Exactly.
Speaking of things not going as planned, the article brings up this DEI program at the University of Michigan that they say backfired. Apparently, according to a New York Times review, the program might have actually increased racial bias and hostility on campus.
Wow.
Are there other examples of DEI programs having these kinds of negative unintended consequences?
Unfortunately, yeah, there are. The goals of DEI are great, but actually putting them into practice, it's really, really hard.
Yeah, it's not easy.
You're dealing with these deeply rooted societal problems, and there can be a lot of pushback.
Resistance.
Right. It's kind of like trying to turn this giant ship.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time, careful planning, and you have to be ready to adapt. Because if it's not done well, these efforts, you know, they can end up having the opposite effect. Like in that Michigan case.
So good intentions aren't enough.
No. You need a good plan, and you need to be flexible.
Makes sense. Okay, so where does the article go from here?
Well, they predict that this woke awakening is just the beginning.
Oh, okay.
They say that even though DEI might be fading, the people who support it, they're just going to move on to new targets.
Mm.
And they use a really interesting example to make their point.
Okay, what is it?
They point to this University of Maryland course on, get this, fat studies.
Fat studies. Hold on. Is that even a real thing?
It is.
Wow.
Fat studies is an actual academic field. It looks at the cultural and social and political sides of, well, fatness.
Okay.
They challenge the stigma and discrimination that fat people face. And they look at how body size intersects with other kinds of oppression.
Like racism, sexism, things like that.
Exactly.
So it's a real area of study. But it sounds like the article is saying that it's just another way to divide people, to stir up trouble.
That's the implication, yeah. They're basically making a slippery slope argument. Like, if we acknowledge and address one kind of oppression,
mm-hmm.
it'll just lead to an endless cycle of finding new oppressed groups and then demanding everyone get special treatment.
But isn't that a bit of a stretch?
Yeah.
Just because we acknowledge that people experience discrimination based on their body size, it doesn't mean we're creating a society where everyone gets a trophy just for participating.
You got it.
Right.
It's so important to be able to see the difference between genuine efforts to be more equitable and inclusive
mm-hmm.
and the kind of fear-mongering tactics that are often used to discredit those efforts.
Mm.
The article, the way it portrays fat studies, you know, as this radical, divisive thing,
right.
it ignores the actual experiences of people who are fat and face real bias, often systemic bias.
So it feels like they're building up this straw man argument.
Yeah.
You know, creating this exaggerated version of the other side just to make it easier to tear down.
You got it. And that brings us to a really crucial point. Critical thinking.
Right.
We need to be able to recognize these rhetorical tactics, you know?
Yeah.
And evaluate the information we're being given carefully.
Especially now, with just so much information being thrown at us all the time.
Exactly.
Okay. So this article we're talking about, it's presenting a very specific viewpoint. One that's rooted in certain political beliefs.
Right.
I guess it's important to seek out different points of view, right?
Absolutely. And to consider the bigger social and historical context of these debates.
That's a great point. It's so easy to get caught up in all the rhetoric and lose sight of the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
So where do we go from here? Are we stuck in this endless culture war where every difference becomes a battleground? I guess those are some things to think about as we continue our deep dive.
That's the big question, isn't it? And I think this article, it really taps into that anxiety that a lot of people feel about these, you know, culture wars.
It's exhausting. And this article, it doesn't really offer any solutions, does it?
Yeah.
It's just like, see, this is what happens.
Right. It's this narrative of just constant division and grievance. But we have to remember, it's just one perspective. And a pretty pessimistic one at that.
Okay.
It's like only looking at the cracks in the sidewalk and not the whole sidewalk.
So how do we move past all this doom and gloom? How do we change the conversation from fear and division to something, you know, more productive?
I think, for one thing, we need to be more critical of these really simple us versus them stories.
Right.
They're meant to make us emotional, not think clearly. Like those clickbait headlines, you know?
Oh, yeah. I know those. They're hard to resist.
Exactly. Yeah. But we have to resist that knee-jerk reaction and dig a little deeper. Like, who's giving us this information? What are they trying to do? What's missing from the story?
It's about being more media literate.
Right. Exactly. And being willing to engage with viewpoints that are different from our own, not to necessarily change our minds, but to at least understand where they're coming from.
That sounds a lot harder than just scrolling through social media and getting mad.
It is. It takes work. And yeah, it can be uncomfortable. But I think it's necessary if we want to bridge these gaps.
Okay, so let's say we're up for the challenge.
Hmm.
How do we actually have these difficult conversations without it turning into a shouting match?
That's where things like active listening and empathy come in.
Okay.
Trying to really understand the other person's point of view, even if we don't agree with it.
So putting ourselves in their shoes. Even if we'd never wear those shoes.
Exactly. And remembering that most people aren't bad people, right? They're just trying to figure things out based on their own experiences and beliefs.
That's a good point. It's easy to forget that, especially online. There are real people behind those screens.
Exactly.
People with their own lives and feelings.
Right. Remembering that shared humanity is, I think, the first step to finding common ground.
Okay, so we're listening, we're trying to understand, but what about when we come across those really deeply held beliefs that are totally opposite from our values? How do we handle that?
Well, it's important to remember that we don't have to agree on everything to have a decent conversation.
Right.
Sometimes it's just about finding some overlap.
Like maybe we disagree about the role of government, but we both think education is important.
Exactly. Or we have different views on social programs, but we both want to see less poverty.
Right.
Finding that common ground can help build trust.
So it's about focusing on what we share, not what divides us.
Exactly. And even when we can't find common ground, we can still talk to each other respectfully.
Yeah.
Explain our views clearly and calmly. No personal attacks, no insults.
That takes practice, especially online, where it's so easy to just, you know, say something mean.
It does. It's like learning a whole new language, the language of civil discourse.
Right.
And like any language, it takes time and effort.
But it's worth it, right?
Absolutely.
If it means we can have these better conversations and maybe even bridge some of these divides.
Because at the end of the day, we're all in this together. We share this planet, this country, and we have to find ways to get along.
Well said. So how do we get past all this polarized rhetoric and these overly simplistic narratives? How do we create spaces for real understanding and dialogue? I guess those are some questions we can think about as we wrap up this deep dive. It feels like we're at this kind of turning point, right? Like figuring out how to even talk about this stuff without, you know, falling into the same old traps of getting outraged and divided. And this article, it just uses such loaded language, loke, Marxist, almost like those words by themselves should be enough to end the conversation.
It's a really powerful tactic for sure. You know, these labels, they're like these shortcuts that trigger all these assumptions and baggage.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to have a reasonable conversation about anything when you're arguing about what the words even mean.
Exactly.
And I think that's where this idea of the silent majority comes in. The article makes it sound like there are all these people just waiting for the chance to speak out against these so-called woke ideas. Do you think that's true?
Well, the silent majority, it's a powerful idea, that's for sure.
Right.
It makes people feel like they're not being heard, like their values are being ignored or even ridiculed by a small but loud group.
Yeah.
And it's true. There are definitely people out there who don't agree with the ideas and policies that are often connected to DEI and social justice movements. But we have to remember that public opinion is hardly ever a simple yes or no.
Okay.
There's a whole range of views on these things, and it's way more complicated than these simple labels make it seem.
So it's not just woke versus anti-woke.
Exactly. People's views are complicated. You know, someone might support racial equality but feel uncomfortable with some DEI initiatives. Or they might agree with the overall goals of social justice, but not like the way people are going about trying to achieve them. When we reduce all this to these simple labels, we miss the real conversations we should be having.
It's like trying to put together this huge puzzle, but we're only allowed to use two pieces. No wonder we can't see the whole picture.
Right. And I think that's the real challenge, moving past these ready-made stories and actually dealing with how complicated these issues are in a way that's both honest and productive.
So how do we do that? How do we resist just making things simple and actually deal with the nuances?
I think it starts with being curious.
Okay.
A willingness to ask questions, to really listen to different points of view, and to challenge our own assumptions.
So instead of rejecting something because it's labeled woke or conservative, we actually try to understand the ideas behind it.
Exactly. And that might mean reading articles from different places, listening to podcasts with different viewpoints, talking to people who have different opinions.
Right.
It's about getting a wider view and realizing that there's more than one way to see things.
It's like they say, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. We have to be around people who make us think differently.
Absolutely. And it's not always comfortable. These conversations can be hard.
Right.
Even frustrating sometimes. But that's where I think we really learn and grow, when we have to face our own biases and really wrestle with difficult ideas and try to communicate across those differences.
So maybe the real woke awakening isn't about picking a side, but about understanding how complex these things really are and realizing we need to have these thoughtful, nuanced conversations.
I like that. It's about realizing these conversations aren't about winning or losing. It's about figuring out how to move forward together.
Right.
And that means being willing to listen, to learn, and to find that common ground, even when it seems impossible.
Well said. So there you have it, everyone. A deep dive into this whole idea of a woke awakening. And we talked about how hard it is to talk about these things without, you know, getting angry or dividing ourselves even more. We looked at all the strong language people use and the fears that are driving these debates. But we also saw that there might be a better way. A way to talk about these things honestly and hopefully, recognizing that even though we might not always agree, we can still find ways to connect, to learn from each other, and to build a world that's fairer and more just for everyone. So here's one last thought for you to consider. How can you make these conversations better, both in your own life and in the world around you? Until next time, keep diving deep.